Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
I'm Nathan Egger for Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we're bringing you an episode from Real Vision's Masterclass series. When Rick Rule appeared on Macro Voices, Eric Townsend very intentionally took the interview in a direction that would challenge both Mr. Rule and our audience. In this interview with Grant Williams from March 25th, 2016, you'll get an opportunity to hear more about Mr. Rule's history and how he got into the natural resource business in the first place. He'll discuss his mentors, his greatest hits, and some of his biggest blunders along the way. I hope you all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation.
The whole idea of the Masterclass series is to talk to people who've been around and have seen a few things, and no one fits that description better than my guest today, Rick Rule. Rick, welcome.
Thank you, Grant. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to see you. And this is a perfect time for me to get a chance to sit and talk to you, because we're at a point where this whole mining cycle seems to be bottoming, and there's a few people getting excited again. And so what better time to sit down with someone that's seen this happen so many times and just try and pick through your story and try and learn a few lessons that people can actually get a sense of what happens to these things. So if you could, I want to take you all the way back to the beginning and go back to the young Rick Rule, and what got you into mining in the very first place?
Ironically, I liked the outdoors. I wanted to be involved in something that had to do with land, earth science. I was fascinated with farming, fascinated with the oil and gas business as a kid. So I'm one of those people who actually did what he set out to do when he was young. I chose the University of British Columbia to go to university for two reasons, really. One, they had a deep expertise in natural resource finance. The other had more to do with the time in 1970 when I made up my mind. A young American was going to travel, that was for sure, a male. And I had a choice sort of in my mind between Vancouver and Saigon. Vancouver, obviously, was a more attractive opportunity for me. Worse weather, but no one shooting at me. And a fortuitous choice for a lot of reasons. But in truth, in the decade of the 70s, which, as you'll recall, was an amazing era for natural resources. The gold price went from $35 to $850. The oil price from $3 to $30. I accidentally found myself in the center of an absolutely epic bull market. Particularly interesting for a young man, other people in finance and conventional finance were in the middle of a terrible bear market. I did well, they did poorly. And like many young men, I confused a bull market with brains. I thought I had something to do with that epic increase in commodity prices and the subsequent increase in my own wealth. When the 80s came, and everyone's fortunes were reversed, that is, when that bull market came to a screeching halt, my fortune did too. And I went from being an extremely wealthy young man, self-made, I thought, to having a negative net worth. And that taught me the lesson of cyclicality in resources. It taught me the slogans I use in public speaking today, that in cyclical businesses, one is either a contrarian or one will become a victim. And also, of course, that bear markets are the authors of bull markets, and bull markets are the authors of bear markets. It was a painful but a useful upbringing.
But what does it feel? So when you come out of university, and you're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and excited about the world, and you walk into that environment, which has always been staffed by old, crusty, dusty guys, of which you and I have now become. But what is it like to be a young guy in a raging bull market like that?
It's incredibly dangerous. What happens is that the narrative becomes convenient to you. And because you succeed in it, particularly where other young men are failing, the narrative becomes almost religious. One of the reasons why I was such an effective salesman as a young man, I worked very, very, very hard.
Well, you still do. I mean, I know that.
But the other thing is that I had no hesitation. I was convinced I was right. You know, when you're a young man, before you had some experience, you know it all.
Yeah.
And I was certainly guilty of that. I was disabused of that a little later in my career very thoroughly. But the truth is that I was an absolutely remarkable salesman, something for which I feel a strong remorse today. The older people who had some hesitation were absolutely no competition for me whatsoever. Yeah. I just steamrolled over them because I didn't know enough to have any caution. And in the middle stages of a bull market, that's an extremely useful thing.
Sure.
Other people with more common sense get shaken out, but a young man like me just keeps rolling along.
did you have a mentor? Did you have one guy who kind of took you under his wing and taught you things, or were you just thinking?
Grant, I was so lucky. I had a lot of mentors. I was easy to mentor because I was absolutely focused, absolutely determined, and absolutely enthusiastic. I was the kind of person that I like to mentor now.
Right.
I was relentless in extracting information. One of the interesting anecdotes that might amuse some of your audience is that I had to put myself through university for various reasons. And through a series of mistakes, I ended up owning a bar while I was still in university. And that bar became sort of the epicenter for entertainment for the nascent financial services community in Vancouver. And some of the old dragons in Vancouver who came to really lead the speculative resource business, people like Peter Brown, were consistent customers. And I was such an earnest young man that I'd pour them whiskey, get them to the state where they wanted to talk, ask them questions, excuse myself saying I had work to do, and I'd run in the back of the bar, and I had a little spiral notebook where I'd write down the answers. And then I'd come back and pour him some more whiskey and I'd ask him some more questions, right? I was an extraordinarily earnest young guy. And when I told these guys those stories years later, they were horrified, wondering what damage they'd done to my career. But I was really relentless. I would say that my first determined mentor, the first person who understood that he was mentoring me, was a legendary deep value investor, Peter Kundal, who I met accidentally. I had no idea who he was. I had no idea that I had the extraordinary fortune to be under the tutelage of an absolutely legendary deep value investor who decided he liked me. And so he spent an awful lot of time with me. Here in Toronto, Ned Goodman was an important mentor. And again, he had absolutely no reason, nothing to win, for all the guidance that he gave me. I was very fortunate. There were so many, and I sought them out shamelessly and aggressively and pummeled them with questions.
But there's something about this business, and I don't know whether it's because so many people in it feel so beaten down for such long periods of time. There's a real camaraderie in this business, despite the fact that, excuse me, it's a very cutthroat business in many ways. There always seems to be, when I talk at conferences and travel around and meet people, people are willing to share knowledge. Let's not say information, but people mm-hmm. are willing to share knowledge and kind of pass on stuff for this up and coming generation. I mean, is that me not being in this enough, or is that?
I think probably. There is a lot in the industry that passes for knowledge that's misinformation. Certainly in my own experience, I was mentored well and thoroughly. I don't think that that's ubiquitous. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do now that I'm towards the end of my own career is help younger people who are also determined and share the information that was shared with me. I think that the industry needs to do a better job of passing on information. In particular, the extractive industry on a global basis needs to transfer information from people who look like me, older Caucasian males, to the people who will wear the mantle in the future, not all of whom are male and most of whom aren't Caucasian.
Sure.
because there's a there's a cultural history and a cultural bias, not necessarily a bad thing, in extractive industries that's very much Western and very much Caucasian. And the nature of the global economy is not. And it makes absolute sense that the mantle will change from the people who ran the business in the past to the people who run the business in the future. And I'd like to, in my own small way, be part of that. It's fun for me.
So how did you, just go, we're going to go back to this fresh-eyed young buck. You're out there, you're selling stuff. When was the first time you got involved in, you know, a major discovery? Talk us through what that, because everyone talks about finding a gold mine or whatever, but just talk a little bit about what that's like.
There were a couple of them. I got involved with the McLeod family, we, right away, discovered a deposit that became North Air, a little penny stock that started paying dividends. And I had come out of the oil and gas business. My first mining deal, the first one I'm involved in, I'm probably 21 or 22, is a success. And I was thinking, you know, this mining is a really, really, really good business. Dumb as dirt, not knowing that 1 in 5,000 mineralized anomalies becomes a mine. And I whack my first one. The second or third deal I was involved in was a private tax-advantaged exploration program in Southern California. It was called ChemGold, utilizing a then brand new technology called heap leaching on oxide gold deposits. And the tax shelter worked, so people in those days, I think they got like a 3-to-1 write-off. So a guy who puts up $100,000 gets $300,000 deduction in those days in the 70% tax bracket, whether or not the mine worked. You were ahead on an after-tax basis. They were stupid days. That worked, and they got stock in something that became called Glamis, which is now Goldcorp. Mm-hmm. So my early career in mining was ludicrous. And again, I confused extraordinary luck with talent. Being part of discoveries that early with people that were as good as the people I was involved with, Adolf Lundin, who went on to become an absolute legend, Chester Miller, who I started doing business with in 1975 when I was 23. It's not as though I had the good sense to select those people. I had the good fortune to be extremely aggressive and extremely hardworking. I offered utility to those people because they had brains and experience and I had legs. The excitement of a discovery and the excitement of helping people around you, investors, build wealth, it was extremely heady. Later on, I was involved in financing or helping to finance the discovery of the Moore Sams gas field in southern Louisiana, which was sold in 1979 for $1.1 billion. It was a $15 million exploration program. I forget what the development costs were, but suffice it to say, the return on capital employed was idiotic. So much success so fast, I had no idea what a hard business it was. Right. I was to learn that, of course.
But that was my next question. So what's it, when you've had this success, when you get that first kick in the teeth, what does that feel like? Because that must be... It would be better if that came first, right?
When you had so much success. It would have been better. I remember wandering around selling things, investment products, resource-related investment products, in 1980 and 1981, which was the absolute tippy-top blow-off insane peak. And not knowing any better, I thought that all the big names knew well. So when I'd make a presentation to an audience, I'd say, I'm not going to give you my price forecasts because I'm a 27-year-old. You don't care about my price forecasts. I'm going to give you the World Bank forecasts, the Exxon forecasts, the Bank of America forecasts, and the Royal Bank forecasts. And they were all idiotic. They were all informed by Jimmy Carter and the Club of Rome. You'll recall in those days, the narrative was Malthusian.
Yeah.
And people tended to extrapolate trends in motion ad infinitum, ad absurdium, basically.
Yeah.
And so in 1980, the prevailing wisdom, if that's what you can call it, among the institutional investors was that the oil price was going to go from $30 to $100. people were going to be starving. There was going to be mass starvation, all this kind of stuff. And it was, frankly, a very convenient narrative for a young guy who was long all that stuff. But I was able to use other people's numbers, establishment numbers. All of the establishment took leave of the fact that markets work. Very high prices reduce the utility of things to users. And if you increase production as a consequence of margin, and you reduce consumption as a consequence of utility, a rather ugly thing happens to price. And that happened in the resource business in spades. The oil price collapsed from $32 to $12. I, as a young man, was long all this stuff, and I was convinced by my friendly bankers that debt was cheaper than equity. And I had a belief that I was going to be a blue-eyed sheik, which was the phrase in those days. And unfortunately for everyone, I carried a $32 pro forma into a $12 world. I learned that my assets were ephemeral, but my debts were money good. And so I woke up on my 29th birthday. On my birthday every year, I sort of plan out what I hope to accomplish in the year. I assess where I am. And assessing where I was, I found out in my own mind that I had a negative net worth in the seven-digit range.
Right.
Which was interesting.
A 29-year-old man in the late 70s, early 80s, that's...
Yeah, I went from being an extremely wealthy young man to being upside down.
What does that feel like as it's happening? Or does it happen so fast? Because sometimes you kind of feel it happening and you do something to stop it. Or did you think this is temporary?
I did what I could to stop it. But by mid-1981, it was pretty clear to me.
Right.
It was too late. You know, some of the assets, some of the marginal assets I could sell, some of the other assets that were securing the debt weren't so easy
to
sell.
Yeah, it's a familiar sounding problem.
The problem, of course, is at the margin.
Yeah.
What I was able to do in my defense when I understood the predicament I was in is I was very forthright. I went to people I knew and explained what I was going to have to do and what I was going to try and do. And I communicated really, really, really well with my creditors. And I made sure that my creditors got to know each other. I said, if you all work with me, I think I can pay you off. But if one guy wobbles, everybody goes down. And I think the consequence of my forthrightness with my creditors gave me the running room so that by 1986, I was able to pay off everybody, principal and interest. Amusingly for me, one of the creditors was a Canadian chartered bank that's no longer in existence. And 6 weeks after I had paid the bank off as to principal and interest, the bank went bankrupt, which I found rather amusing.
Yeah,
I preserved my good name with a broke bank.
I'm fascinated by this because this isn't the thinking of a normal 29-year-old boom bust kid, right? I mean, was that approach of sitting down, thinking this problem through, getting the creditors together and all on the same page. Was that something that you instinctively and intuitively knew, or did you get counseling through this? Is this something you'd observe in someone else? It's not normal, Rick.
Well, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I didn't borrow the money conditionally. You know, I didn't borrow the money with the caveat that I'll pay it back if, as and when it's convenient.
Right.
I was far too stubborn and far too proud to go bankrupt, which I'm frankly proud of.
Absolutely, as you should be.
And some of the people who watched me go through that approved of it and became extraordinary backers of my career later on. I'm thinking of one example would be Leonard Spotcheck, who succeeded Arthur Andersen as chairman of Arthur Andersen. Mm-hmm. He watched that process. And the consequence of that was that Leonard became a client. And he was an enormous center of influence and delivered me an awful lot of business. And being a young man backed by people like Leonard Spotcheck, you know, really it was a question of when, not if, I was going to recover. And, you know, my creditors were a good lot. I think one of the smart things I did was put them in touch with each other and make them a club, because I knew that any one of four people pulling the plug would cause them all to lose money. So there was some, I mean, I didn't know how to do this then. I know how to do it now. There was some intercreditor pressure, and I sort of fashioned the intercreditor agreement, which is interesting because, you know, later in my career, I did lots of insolvency and bankrupt work, and I'm a lender and distressed debt investor today. It's interesting that that experience, that personal experience, gave me a career skill that's very rare and very valuable today.
Yeah, and you know, I've seen you. You and I have been at conferences having dinner, and I've seen you trying to hide because you know that everyone's going to come to you for for exactly this kind of conversation. So you know, you set yourself up as that guy, and you're right. It's an incredibly rare skill.
Yes, it is.
So okay, so we're back here. We've had the boom. We've had the bust. You're back on your feet. The lessons that you take away from that, I mean, are they very conscious, or are these things that subconsciously have gone in, or are you now, have you changed your complete outlook on how you approach this business?
Absolutely. Grant, if you care about this, if you're ego involved, if you live to work rather than work to live, going from an extremely wealthy young guy with a lot of respect and a lot of self-esteem to sub-zero, in your own mind, a scoundrel, it provides an absolutely deep scar. I joke that our fee business is trading scar tissue for fees, and I have a deep reservoir of scar tissue to trade still.
Yeah.
It taught me the true nature of extractive industries, not just mining. They're capital intensive, which means when the market goes over the edge, the industry cannibalizes its capital to keep producing. So the bear markets last longer than they would in other industries. By the time you're done with it, you've destroyed a bunch of productive capacity. So when you get a price response, you don't get a market response. So the median is theoretical because you overshoot the median in both directions, which is a very fancy way of saying that it's an extremely cyclical business, a business that's more cyclical than any other business I know of. And if you lose track of that fact, which almost every market participant does, you get murdered.
Yeah.
I've learned, and mercifully this is not true for me, human nature is to anticipate the future based on your experience in the immediate past. In the circumstance that we're in now, people ignore the fact that a resource bull market is inevitable. Because their experience in the last 5 years has been so ugly. Everything they've done, smart or stupid, they've been spanked for. And the normal response to being spanked is to become risk averse, which is precisely the opposite of what you have to do in resources. I was addressing a crowd at the PDAC yesterday, mining people who would be predisposed to hear good noise. But outside of gold, they don't want to hear anything. And I said to the audience, so show of hands, this speech is going to give itself. How many of you believe that 7 years from now, when you walk from your bedroom to the garage and turn the key to the right, that the car is going to start and run? Show of hands. Everybody raised their hand. I said, well, that means that you believe that the oil price is going to go up, because right now it costs the industry $60 to make a barrel and they sell it for $32. They lose $28 a barrel and try and make it up on volume. One of two things happens. The price goes up to the level where the industry can earn its cost of capital, or there's no gasoline. So all of you were bullish on the oil price without knowing it. That's the lesson that you learn in the context of going from rich to poor to rich.
Right. But you have a really unique way of stepping back and looking. I've quoted you in more presentations than I care to remember, because I'm always looking for quotes, and they always seem to come from you for some reason. But you have this ability to step back in what is, as you've said, the most cyclical industry, which therefore, by definition, has to be the most contrarian industry of all.
Yes.
Why do so many people find it so hard to be contrarians in this business?
I don't know the answer to that. I think probably most people are invested in the lifestyle rather than investing in success in the industry. I think the truth is inconvenient for many people. At the top of the cycle, everybody's making money. Everybody's earning fees. Everybody wants to be a success. People don't have the nerve, the courage to step off the train.
In
2014, I was lamenting a bit of my own stupidity with Ned Goodman, a mentor. And I said, Ned, this is my third major down cycle, my fourth real down cycle. And I made the same mistake. In 2010, there wasn't much to buy. I did some selling. Why didn't I sell the rest of the portfolio? If there's nothing to buy, the market is saying it's time to sell. Right?
Yeah.
And Ned said, you'll do it again, too. And I don't mind sharing this with your audience. I said, what is this, Gentile bashing? I mean, what?
Right.
Why is this? He said, no, it's hubris. He said, the truth is, Rick, that you've done one thing all your life. You're really good at it. And you believe that you're better than your competitors. And it's true, you are. And you believe that the management teams that you back are better. And it's true, they are. And that your companies have better balance sheets, which they do. And the projects are better, which they are. But when the market goes over the edge, none of that matters. And so the truth is that the way that the industry works is that all of us, with whatever we carry into the bad market, we lose half of.
Right.
Now, sidebar, in this cycle, we lost half, then we lost half, then we lost half again. It's down by 90%. But what Ned said next was really instructive. He said, but what happens is that at the market bottom, the good players acknowledge their mistakes, reposition what's left of their portfolio, and they enjoy a tenfold escalation in the upcycle. So if you want to put it to numbers, this is Ned, not Rick. A guy takes 100,000 into the cycle, and they always come in at the top the first time. They lose half, so they're down to 50. But the good guys persevere, and they turn the 50 into 500. If you think about it, over the course of a decade, he turned 100 into 500, which is really good performance. It's just that the process is so painful.
Yeah.
So the nature of my talk yesterday was sort of parenthetically, for Ned, you've lived through the pain. Will you have the courage to hang out for the gain?
Yeah.
Because the truth is, in the early part of a bull market, there are inevitable retrenchments. And the nature of the retrenchment, if you've just gone through 5 years of hell, is that it was a head fake. It wasn't a real bull market. And so many people get shaken out in the early stages of a bull market.
Yeah, every time.
Yes.
You see, I go back and forth. I can't work out if it's harder to step in at the bottom of a cycle when everyone else is selling, or it's harder to step away at the top and leave money on the table. And people struggle with both.
Yes.
And they're both equally difficult to do, but the smart guys seem to be able to do both, right? That's...
Well, you do some of both, in truth.
Right.
The truth is that, at least in my experience and the experience of every single investor and speculator I know, is that they leave money on the table at the top and they leave money at the table at the bottom. But if you make a whole bunch in the middle, that's okay. Your expectations have to be rational. You know, I think it was Bernard Baruch that said that the only guy who ever bought everything at the bottom and sold everything at the top was a liar.
Right.
It didn't happen.
So this current cycle we're in. I did an interview with Dave Iben, who's another you know Dave, and is a great contrarian, deep value investor.
Great generalist. Yeah.
Yeah. And I sat listening to Dave, and he makes it sound so easy. And when you step back far enough and you say, well, buy everything when everyone's selling it, and sell it back to them when everyone's buying it, it really does sound not only perfectly straightforward and understandable, but simple to do. And yet, I don't know what it is about this business, but mining in particular, as we've established, is perhaps everything else magnified to a power of 10. Where are we now in this cycle right now, which seems to the people in it who perhaps don't have your experience, how does this compare with previous cycles you've seen? Because it feels
vicious.
Yeah.
Really
okay.
Vicious. If you follow the thought that bull markets are the authors of bear markets, the commodity bull market and the emerging bull market that we enjoyed from 2001 to 2010 was epic.
Mm-hmm.
And the sins that had to be exercised from the system were vast. And they were. A normal bear market cycle measured in the TSXV, the venture exchange, is a 50% decline. And we had that by 2013. And then it fell by 50% again. And then for good measure, it fell by 50% a third time. This is unparalleled since we've been able to measure. The bear market that we experienced in the early part of the 1980s was the same, but there was no index to measure.
Yeah.
But this was truly an epic bear market. And it's not over, by the way, in my estimation. I think we're at... I think we're at the point where the market probably goes sideways. And I'm talking about the non-gold mm-hmm. resource market for a while. But I see a blow up in particular energy junk debt in the third quarter of this year that probably lasts 18 months, which will probably be the last really superb investment opportunity of my career.
Yeah,
it's going to be very, very, very painful for the people who ride into it. And I think it's going to be an absolutely unique opportunity for those people who understand how to play it.
I've spoken to so many people recently who are already combing through what they see as the wreckage.
Right.
Right. And they're saying, I need to know which companies should I be looking at, where's the debt, what should I be buying? And here's you sitting back saying, you know, there's another 6 to 9 months of this, and then is the time to step in, perhaps.
The really great investors have a deep capacity for pain. And buying something 2 years before it recovers so that you can study it, understanding that you'll be ecstatic in 5 years and in some agony in 12 months is a real skill.
Yeah.
There are securities I would buy today, understanding that they'll go lower. I have a pretty good capacity for pain myself. But I see a set of circumstances unfolding where my suspicion is that it won't hurt me to wait.
Right.
It may be that I'm wrong a little bit and the prices are 15% higher, and that's actually okay. But my virtue and my sin with regards to this are the same. I have a very straightforward process. I say if A is true, B is true, C is true, D is true, E is true, and the sum, the consequence of all that, is this occurring? I confuse two words in English. One is inevitable and the other is imminent. I know that the outcome is inevitable, but I often make mistakes with regards to timing.
Yeah.
The thesis that I give you with regards to the junk bonds is pretty specific. The public oil and gas companies in North America will publish their annual reports next month, mm-hmm. and they'll contain a third-party estimate of the net present value of their reserves. Last year, banking regulators and securities regulators allowed the companies to employ consultants who used forward price decks that were at substantial variance from the forward strip. My experience has been that when that difference occurs, the delta is reconciled in favor of the market, not the myth. So the median forecast for 2016 was $55 US a barrel, but the market's at 33. So when they figure the net present value this year, remember the most important part of net present value is present.
Right.
The variance from last year's valuations is going to be extraordinary. The primary credit facility in the oil and gas business is something called a revolving credit facility. It's an evergreen facility that's reserves-based. It's a function of a proportion of the company's reserves. And they don't pay principal. They pay interest, provided that their reserves valuations keep growing. But when the reserves shrink, the evergreen loan gets turned into a term loan where they make principal repayments. And the collision between this credit facility and these reserves valuations is going to be extremely noisy. It's going to be particularly noisy in the junk bond market, which is subordinated to the senior secured, mm-hmm. and noisier yet for the equity holders. Remember, when people disparage junk bonds, that the worst piece of debt is better than the best piece of equity on any individual balance sheet. So I see complete carnage in the second biggest industry in the world because the people who bought this crap were yield-oriented, not yeah. credit-oriented. They bought oil and gas cash flows without any sense that they ought to correlate sustaining capital expenditures, debt maturities, and all that kind of thing with free cash flow. And my suspicion is that if the sector blows up in the fashion that I believe it will, that the same people who bought indiscriminately will sell indiscriminately. Parenthetically, both oil and gas will be four-letter words. And sorting through that wreckage separating the wheat from the chaff is something I very much look forward to. At age 63, it's probably the last extraordinary buying opportunity I have in my career. And as you can tell by looking at me, since there's going to be widespread pain and suffering anyway, somebody ought to be able to laugh through it.
Right. There are times when that's all we've got left. I mean, it seems in the last few years. I mean, it's that thinking that you're really... I've been fortunate enough through this project to speak to so many really smart investors. And if there's the one thing, this seam that runs through, it's the ability to sit back and just with cold eyes assess this. And you talk about pain, and yes, it can be painful for a lot of people. It's been painful. But not many people sit there and talk about the upcoming bust as a tremendous opportunity. It's only the really focused, diligent investors that get to do that.
Well, I've paid some rent in the bear market.
Yes, so sure.
I'm entitled to reap some reward.
Absolutely.
One watching this video shouldn't suggest that I didn't make some mistakes in the bear market.
No.
But you become psychologically prepared to take advantage of carnage when it occurs.
Well, and you've owned them, right? You've owned those mistakes. And that is the thing I see that people don't do. They always blame the cycle, or they blame whatever. They'll blame Russia for going into Ukraine. People don't tend to own their mistakes in this business, because if you do that, there's some stigma attached to it that you're either cursed or you're not a good resource investor or whatever it may be.
No, you're right. You must be self-honest. The truth is that the biggest risk in every investment is to the left of your right ear and to the right of your left ear. It's really all down to you.
Yeah, that's so true. So when you look across the landscape today, we're in this I don't know what inning we're in, if you want to use the baseball metaphor of this bust. But when you look across, where do you see, perhaps, apart from the junk bond debt to come in 6 to 9 months, where do you see value in the commodity space now? Because
for those who are patient,
right,
all over the place. The oil and gas business, I mean, if you think about it, if it takes $60 to make it and you sell for $32, ultimately it's a self-correcting problem. The uranium business, everybody hates uranium. But everybody, when they walk into a room and flip a switch, wants the light to go on. Mm. There's two choices. The uranium price can go up or the lights can go off. Your choice.
But uranium is something that, a lot of people have been talking uranium for 2 or 3 years now. And I feel similarly. I think uranium is one of the great bull markets to come. But
it could take 3 years more.
Yeah.
If you go back to the last market in uranium, it became very clear to me in the last part of the decade of the 90s that the uranium price had to go up. So I got involved in 1998. The uranium price didn't move until 2002. On a net present value basis, if you discount being 4 years early at a 10% discount, usually you're not early, you're wrong.
Right.
But the truth is, in uranium, the up market was, bad pun, so explosive that there was almost no net present value rent that couldn't be overcome.
Right.
That's what's important to recognize. If you are a uranium producer and it costs you $40 a pound to make the stuff, you're selling at spot at 32 and you're selling some at term at 45. So let's say you're swapping bucks at 40. The price goes from 40 to 50, and a 20% escalation in the uranium price gives you a 10-fold increase in margin. An increase from 40 to 60 gives you a 20-fold increase in margin. The same time that that happens, some of your marginal rock, which was resource, becomes reserve.
Yeah.
So your business gets bigger as your margin goes up, and the market values your cash flow better. So you get these sort of triple plays. The last time through, the poster child was, of course, Paladin.
Yeah.
The Australian stock, which went from 1 penny to $10. It's those type of absurd outsized moves that people need to pay attention to. In a bear market, your memory of those fades while your memory of your failures is front and center. And it's important in a bear market to remember the bull market narrative and to understand that bear markets are always the cause of bull markets. So with regards to uranium, the point of that soliloquy With regards to uranium, is I'm entirely comfortable with the fact that from here it could take me 3 years to be right. But I'm also importantly by now familiar with the fact that if I ask myself questions that must begin with when, not if, I'll do better over time than my competitors who ask themselves questions where the answer begins with if.
Yeah.
With uranium and oil, those are when questions, Grant. They're not if questions.
Yeah, so how do you differentiate between being wrong and being early? Because sometimes you can be wrong, right?
I acknowledge a flaw in my character.
Okay.
And that's a flaw that's common with all value investors. All value investors are logical to an absurd extent. And we all share that same problem. We're all early. We all see a set of circumstances where the existing narrative is wrong and we bet against it. But the truth is that the market, as it's so often said, the market can stay irrational for an extraordinarily long time. But that's okay, it ends up. If you are early, if you have the tools, both the financial tools and the psychological tools to stay the trade, being early is better than late.
Sure. Sure, but at what point do you acknowledge, you know what, I'm wrong?
If
assuming you have.
Something changes in the fact. When I have discussions with regards to energy, people say to me things like, what about solar? Yeah. So you must question solar. When I think about solar, I think about night, and I realize that people want power at night. I also think about the fact that you know, the second law of thermodynamics, the inefficiency of non-concentrated energy. You know, you think about durable competitive advantage. You think about the fact that in the California market where I live, the price we used to pay for nuclear energy was 6.2 cents a kilowatt hour, and the price we pay for solar is 22 cents a kilowatt hour. And I think about how that's going to play out in a world where people care, but people spend too. And so you look for durable competitive advantages in product. Everybody hates coal, but coal utilization is increasing. The narrative is Obama, carbon, smog. The truth is steel and the lights going on. The idea that the coal industry, which provides 30% of America's baseload power, will continue to produce a couple hundred million tons a year, losing $20 or $30 a ton, is a non-starter. Mm. As long, you'll remember our earlier discussion, if your readers believe that 5 years from now when their car wears out, that they'll be able to buy a new car, then they believe in metallurgical coal, because if you didn't have metallurgical coal, you wouldn't have steel side for cars. If you ask people if they think the coal price is going to go up, uniformly, they say no. If you ask people if they think they'll be able to buy a car in 6 or 7 years, uniformly, they say yes. And there's an irreconcilable dichotomy in those two points of view. Mercifully for me, I've been around long enough to understand how all that works because I've experienced it personally four times now.
Right, right. So where else? I mean, uranium was the first place you went, which is interesting in itself.
Because it has to happen.
You're right, yeah. but it tends to be the last place most people go.
Right.
So there's a sign. But where else do you see value?
Well, certainly coal. I am making very, very, very long-term bets on iron ore. I'm trying to buy iron deposits that have had $200 or $300 million spent on them that won't be economic until the iron price doubles. Mm-hmm. Where I can buy them for $1 million or $2 million and then warehouse them for 10 years. I love to be places that other people hate. I had a wonderful lesson in this 15 years ago. I financed a wonderful entrepreneur and close friend of mine, Ross Beattie, when the copper industry fell apart. And the copper industry was where we are in many other industries today. The copper industry was producing copper for about $1.50 a pound. And they were selling it for 85 cents. So they were losing 65, 70 cents a pound and, of course, trying to make it up on volume. There were all these copper projects that the industry had spent all this money on that didn't make any money. And both Ross and I believed that the copper price had to go up So we went to these big mining companies and we bought copper projects from them that couldn't make any money until $1.50 or $2 copper. And they were basically free. Deposits that people spent $90 million on, and we could buy them for $2 million. That was called Lumina Copper. We did the first deal at 50 cents. We liquidated the company 8 years later for $160 a share. Now, the point of that is that if you make a few bets like that, that are non-correlated, with the understanding, first of all, that it might take a long time to be right, and secondly, that some of them might not work, the truth is that capital that you deploy at 50 cents that you harvest at 160, and by the way, I sold all the way along, don't confuse me with somebody who got both trades right, you make such an absurd amount of money on the outlying successes that it amortizes the failure in the portfolio and leaves a very handsome rate of return if you have the courage to play the game. What's unique about where we are now is that there's opportunity across the stratum. There are so many resource industries that are selling below their aggregate production cost that you, like Warren Buffett said about equities in 1982, he said he felt like a young man in a candy store with no counters. You know, the candy's just lying there for him to pick it up. And every bin looked great. So the oil business looks great to me. It's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
The gas business looks great to me. The coal business looks great to me. The copper business, the zinc business, the lead business, the agricultural minerals businesses. The soft commodities are falling apart. So farmland is going to fall apart.
So is it, I mean, at this point, is it more about building a portfolio than looking at a specific industry and give it spreading your bets?
It absolutely is. And it's about understanding where you want to be on the risk spectrum. For most investors, they want to buy the very, very, very best company. For people willing to do more work and take more risk, the more marginal companies are the ones that give you the best percentage returns. I like to tell people, don't try this at home, you know, because you really have to invest time and treasure. It's psychologically difficult, and you also have to work harder to be right.
Yeah.
For most investors, rather than trolling around the junk bond markets, sometime when everybody in the world hates oil and gas because the credits blew up, most people should buy Exxon.
Right.
Buy the best. In the mining business, in the coal business, in the iron business, most people should buy BHP and Rio. The people who are adventuresome enough and greedy enough that they want to participate in something like I did, like Lumina, better be prepared to take as much pain as I absorbed, and they better be prepared to work as hard as I did. If they're trying to get on with their lives and they think they're going to compete with me, they have another thing coming.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny, right the way through this conversation, you know, we started off talking about mentors, and you know, you mentioned Ross Beaty back then, and it just made me think that In this little sector of the investment community, I don't think there's anywhere where people are more important.
Correct.
And when you're going to go into these projects, you have to be in there with a guy like Ross Beaty, who has, you know, is tremendously widely respected right across the industry, and has proven time and again, he's a stand-up guy who does what you want him to do.
But you know, Grant, in any industry, I think.
No, I agree.
I know resources better, and the reason I stick in resources is because I know who those people are.
Right, precisely. but that's the tricky thing, because it's what happens with this industry, every time you get to not even the peak of the cycle, but that upswing, it sucks in so many people who don't know who those people are. And obviously, so much money gets thrown at the sector, it attracts a lot of people who definitely aren't those people that we're looking for.
Also true.
So how do you... As someone who isn't Rick Rule, how do you figure out the liar standing by the hole in the ground, as Mark Twain said, and the Ross Beatys of the world? How do you figure out? Is it just track record?
Yeah, I think it is track record. I mean, going solely on track record, you miss the emerging superstar cheap. You know, that happens. But the truth is that the probability of catching that emerging superstar cheap is so small that speculating on your ability to do that is probably a waste of money. Let somebody else discover them. Let him or her prove themselves on their own relatives before they prove themselves on your client. The truth is, one of the beauties of a bear market is you can buy the best people in the industry for the same price as you can buy the worst. My friend Robert Friedland, arguably the smartest guy I have ever met in the natural resource business, runs a company right now that's selling at a discount to cash. You don't need to pay up for a neophyte when you get the best mining financier of his generation at a discount to cash. There are reasons for that discount because of the wrapper that Robert is in. But the truth is that right now you can buy Ross Beaty in the alternative energy space, which is actually an attractive space, at what I think is probably a 35% discount to net present value based on cash flows.
Yeah.
In a market like this, the, you know, the sort of Neiman Marcus goods are at Walmart.
Right.
But because people's experience in the immediate past is so bad, the pedigree doesn't matter. Nothing matters. It's wonderful.
Well, I can't finish this conversation without asking you about gold, because if I do, I'll get chased through the streets anywhere I go in the world. So what is your take on gold right now?
Three takes. I own gold personally for reasons of fear, not greed. I've seen a lot of bad things in my life, and I have friends that have seen worse things, including one who grew up in Auschwitz. And you need to consider rather than obsess on the unthinkable. And gold has functioned as insurance for millennia. And I own physical gold with the hopes that I'm wrong. There's no form of insurance that you want to be paid off on, right? The second thing, probably for most of your viewers, something easier to think about. When people think about all the factors surrounding gold, all the reasons that it goes up and down, I try and make my life simpler. And I believe that gold really, truly trades inversely to the U.S. dollar, expressed by the U.S. 10-year treasury. I understand that the U.S. dollar is, relative to other fiat currencies, an okay instrument. My friend Doug Casey says, the worst currency in the world, with the sole exception of all of the others.
Right.
But if you look at the dollar as expressed by the U.S. 10-year treasury, the U.S. 10-year treasury has been in a 35-year bull market. During that period of time, the expressed yield has fallen from 15 to 1.62. So while the U.S. 10-year treasury could improve from here, after a 35-year bull market, I believe that the U.S. dollar as expressed by the 10-year treasury is closer to the top than to the bottom. And if you then follow my thesis that what gold really does is trade inversely to the U.S. 10-year treasury, that means that gold is closer to the bottom than to the top. Could it fall from 1270 to 1000? Absolutely. Does that matter to me? Absolutely not. The other thing that really fascinates me about gold right now, Grant, I read a study 4 months ago. I think it was Morgan Stanley. And they said that gold and gold-related securities occupied 0.25% of the investable assets in the United States. That was down from 8% in 1980 and from a mean of 1.5 to 1.75% over three decades. Reversion to mean would suggest a sixfold increase in demand in an economy that's 24% of the investable assets in the world. So if you think about the fact that, if you accept my thesis is what I should say, that the anti-gold, the 10-year treasury, is closer to the top than the bottom, and therefore gold is closer to the bottom than the top, you don't have to have a situation where gold wins the war against the U.S. 10-year treasury. It only has to lose the war less badly. Mm-hmm. If you had a reversion to half mean, meaning that if gold and precious metal securities occupied 0.75% of the savings matrix of the United States, you triple demand for gold and gold equities in 24% of the world's economy. And that's what I think is going to happen. And I think it's going to be dramatic.
Rick, I couldn't have wrapped up any better. It's been so much fun going through all this stuff with you. And you know, every time you and I get together, I sit and try and listen more than I talk. And hopefully I've done that again today.
Well, thanks so much. I look forward to a rematch. And we can say if all this forward-thinking stuff was hokum or
anytime.
If it was good.
Rick, thanks so much.
Pleasure.